7. Assassination of non-Muslims. One of the arguments on the basis of which it is held that blasphemy is punishable by death is the assassination of certain non-Muslims of the Prophet's times who had allegedly blasphemed against God and the Prophet. Thus, for example, Abu Rafi and Ka'b ibn Ashraf were put to death in their houses. If all these cases are analyzed, it comes to light that this conclusion is incorrect. Once again, we are faced with a situation in which the people assassinated are those who, as per the divine practice discussed in this treatise, had already become worthy of death, once they had intentionally denied the truth after the Prophet's migration to Medina. While most of them were given more time and respite to contemplate on the consequences of their denial, those among them who assumed the role of active adversaries and were spreading disorder and anarchy in society were punished by death after they were repeatedly warned of their highly antagonizing behavior. 9. Prohibition of asking for forgiveness for non-Muslims. A common perception among Muslims is that the following verse of the Quran has stopped them from asking the Almighty for forgiveness of non-Muslims. مَا كَانَ لِلنَّبِيِّ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَن يَسْتَغْفِرُوا لِلْمُشْرِكِينَ وَلَوْ كَانُوا أُولِي قُرْبَى مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا تَبَيَّنَ لَهُمْ أَنَّهُمْ أَصْحَابُ الْجَحِيمِ. It is not proper for the Prophet and those who believe to ask God's forgiveness for the mushrikun, even though they be of kin, after it has become clear to them that they are the dwellers of the fire. Surah number 9, verse 113. Again, it needs to be appreciated, as the verse itself clarifies, that the idolaters of Arabia of the Prophet's times were condemned to hell because of their persistence in denying the truth, in spite of being convinced about it. It was such people about whom, as per the divine practice discussed earlier, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the Muslims were stopped from praying and asking forgiveness. Hence, this verse does not relate to non-Muslims of times after the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his companions. 10. Prohibition of inheritance between Muslims and non-Muslims. On the basis of the following narrative, there are scholars who are of the view that Muslims and non-Muslims cannot mutually inherit from one another. An Usama ibn Zayd, anna Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam qal, la yarithul muslimul kafir wal kafirul muslim. Usama ibn Zayd reported that the Prophet said, a Muslim cannot be an heir to a disbeliever, nor can a disbeliever be an heir to a Muslim. Al-Bukhari, Al-Jami As-Sahih, Volume 6, page 2484, Hadith number 6383. Today, with numerous conversions taking place all over the world, this issue has become very relevant, as often a family ends up in a situation in which one blood relative has entered the folds of Islam. If this hadith is understood in the light of the divine practice discussed in the foregoing pages, one can see that the article Alif Lam is appended to the word Al-Kafir. Giving due consideration to this, an accurate translation of this word would be such a disbeliever. This, in other words, would refer to the disbelievers of the times of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who had deliberately denied the truth. Now, according to the Quran, Surah Nisa, verse 12, the basis of inheritance between relatives is benefit of kinship. If a lack of this benefit is diagnosed in some relations, then the matter of inheritance will be severed between them. After a deliberate denial of the truth by the Quraysh and the people of the book, this benefit of kinship no longer existed between them and the Muslims. Hence, they could not inherit from one another. In other words, this directive is only related to the direct addresses of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and has no bearing on later Muslims. 11. Prohibition of testimony of non-Muslims. There is a consensus among Muslim scholars that the testimony of non-Muslims is inadmissible except in cases of will testaments. The reason for this is that the Quran has asked Muslims to make only those people as witnesses who are their favored ones, and surely the disbelievers cannot be regarded in this category. Here again, the disbelievers under discussion are the ones who, as per the divine practice discussed in this treatise, are those who had denied the truth in spite of being convinced about it, and as a result had earned the wrath of God. Non-Muslims who were not a party to this divine practice are not implied here. 12. Prohibition of imitating non-Muslims. On the basis of the following narrative, scholars opine that Muslims should not adopt the ways and mannerisms of non-Muslims in any way. Thus, for example, they should neither wear their dress nor attend or celebrate their festivals. The following narratives is generally presented in support of this view. An Umar, qala Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, man tashabbaha biqawmin fahuwa minhum. Ibn Umar said that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, he who imitates a nation is from among them. Abu Dawud, Sunan, Volume 4, page 44, Hadith number 4031. An important principle in understanding a hadith is to collect all its variants and then evaluate them. In this regard, if all the variants of this narrative are collated and analyzed, a very different picture emerges. A variant of this narrative reads, An ibn Umar qala qala Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam bu'istu bis-sayf hatta yu'bada Allah la sharika lah wa ju'ila rizqi tahta zilla rumhi wa ju'ila zillatu was-saghar ala man khalafa amri wa man tashabbaha biqawmin fahuwa minhum. Ibn Umar said that the Prophet said, I have been sent with the sword until God alone is worshipped and my livelihood has been placed under the shade of my spear, and there is humiliation and subjugation for those who disobey me, and he who imitates a nation will be regarded from among them. Ahmad ibn Hanbal, Musnad, Volume 2, page 50, Hadith number 5114. A simple analysis of this detailed narrative shows that its last sentence has been quoted out of context and thereby taken to mean an absolute directive which prohibits Muslims from adopting the mannerisms of other nations. If the complete narrative is analyzed, it comes to light that it is nothing but an explanation of the divine practice of God mentioned in the Quran, as discussed in detail in this article. As per this practice, those who had disobeyed the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam were destined to be doomed and humiliated. They would be subjugated by the swords of his companions. Now, this subjugation has been discussed in the Quran in detail. At times, these subjugation campaigns were directed to areas in which Muslims and non-Muslims were living together, and there was no distinction between the two, neither in dress nor in places of residence. On the one hand, the attacking Muslim armies were told by the Quran that if someone whom they attacked said the ceremonial salutation, Assalamu alaikum, to them, then they should not say anything to him and regard him as a Muslim. They should not tell him that he is not a Muslim simply to loot his wealth. The Quran states, Ya ayyuhallazina amanu iza zarabtum fi sabilillahi fatabayyanu wala taqulu liman alqa ilaykumus salama lasta mu'mina tabtaghuna 'arada alhayati ad-dunya fa indallahi maghanim kathira kadhalika kuntum min qabl famanallahu 'alaykum fatabayyanu innallaha kana bima ta'maluna khabira. Believers, investigate when you go to fight for the cause of God, and do not say to those that offer you peace, you are not believers, seeking the booty of this world, for with God is a lot of booty. Previously you were also like this. The Almighty then bestowed on you His grace. Therefore investigate. God is cognizant of all your actions. Surah number 4, verse 94. What is evident from this narrative is that on the other hand, the attacked Muslim inhabitants in such mixed localities must have been told to distinguish themselves from non-Muslim neighbors in some form or the other, lest the attacking Muslim army attacks them too, since they outwardly resemble the non-Muslims. This is what is meant by the last part of the narrative. If all the suppressed and implied portions are unfolded in the light of the Quran, the last part of the narrative would be something like this. Humiliation and subjugation is destined for those who disobey me. So, O you Muslims who live in the areas of non-Muslims, in order to make yourselves known to the attacking Muslim army that you are Muslims, make some distinguishing mark that makes you distinct from non-Muslims. If you do not distinguish yourself, and as a result resemble the non-Muslims, then he who resembles an enemy nation will be regarded among them by the attacking Muslim army. Hence, this narrative has no bearing on wearing the dress or adopting the ways of non-Muslims. In other words, Muslims are not bound in any way in this regard by their religion. Adopting the ways and mannerisms of other nations has been left to their discretion. 13. Struggle for the supremacy of Islam. It is held by some Muslim scholars of contemporary times that it is a religious obligation of Muslims to strive for the supremacy of Islam. If a Muslim country is not following Islam, Muslims must organize an effort to topple its rulers and enforce Islam. An obvious corollary of this viewpoint is that if they are living as minorities in some non-Muslim country, here also they should strive to achieve the supremacy of Islam. They term the struggle an Islamic revolution and present the following verse in support of this view. هُوَ الَّذِي أَرْسَلَ رَسُولَهُ بِالْهُدَى وَدِينِ الْحَقِّ لِيُظْهِرَهُ عَلَى الدِّينِ كُلِّهِ وَلَوْ كَرِهَ الْمُشْرِكُونَ It is he who has sent his Rasul with guidance and the religion of truth, that he may proclaim it over all religions, even though the idolaters may detest this. Surah number 61, verse 9. On the basis of the phrase, all religions in this verse, it is understood that the followers of Islam must struggle for its dominance in their respective countries and territories. An analysis of the context of this verse shows that it also belongs to the divine practice discussed in detail in this treatise. Thus, it is to be noted that the word al-mushrikeen, or the idolaters, is used in this verse. The Quran uses this word specifically for the idolaters of Arabia of the Prophet's times. As a result, the words all the religions in the conjugate clause can only mean all the religions of Arabia at that time. Therefore, the verse has no bearing on Muslims after the times of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It has already been shown in an earlier section that the companions of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam were promised sovereignty in the land of Arabia after the idolaters of Arabia had knowingly denied the message of Muhammad. The Quran states, وَعَدَ اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا مِنْكُمْ وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ لَيَسْتَخْلِفَنَّهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ كَمَسْتَخْلَفَ الَّذِينَ مِنْ قَبْلِهِمْ وَلِيُمَكِّنَنَّ لَهُمْ دِينَهُمُ الَّذِي ارْتَضَىٰ لَهُمْ God has promised those among you who professed belief and did righteous deeds that He will surely grant them political authority in this land as He granted to those before them, that He will establish their religion, the one which He has chosen for them. Surah number 24, verse 55. Consequently, striving to achieve the political supremacy of Islam is no religious obligation of a Muslim. The verses from which this obligation has been construed are specifically linked to a divine practice related to Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his companions. This, of course, does not mean that Muslims should not strive for this cause. It only means that this is not their religious responsibility. Conclusion: Relations with non-Muslims. It is evident from the foregoing discussion that in order to make the reward and punishment that is going to take place in the hereafter an observable reality in this world, the Almighty selects certain personalities called messengers. Their own person becomes a means to communicate the truth to their addressees in a conclusive manner. Besides this powerful and observable means, these messengers also elucidate and explain the truth to their respective peoples. As indicated earlier, this truth is that a person shall one day be held accountable before the Almighty on the basis of his deeds, and then be rewarded and punished accordingly. With the special help and assistance of the Almighty, these messengers remove misconceptions that surround this truth, and vehemently remind people, if they do not accept it, they shall be doomed in this world and in the hereafter. Messengers give glad tidings of success both in this world and in the next to those who profess faith in them. People who deliberately deny the truth are punished in various degrees, so that this whole episode can substantiate the reward and punishment that is to take place on similar grounds in the hereafter. As a consequence of this fundamental premise, what needs to be understood is that some directives of Islam are specific to this divine practice, which relates to the age of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his companions, and cannot be extended to later periods. The reason for this, as pointed out many times before, is that as per the divine practice discussed in the previous sections, these directives relate to non-Muslims who intentionally deny the truth. After the termination of the institution of revelation, no one can know whether a non-Muslim is deliberately denying the truth or not. Only the Almighty knows this. In the age of His messengers, He chose to reveal this judgment through His appointees, while after them He has not chosen to do so. Consequently, it is imperative that Muslims study the Quran and the life of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, which are replete with the details of this divine guidance in the proper perspective. If all these premises are true, then the attitude of Muslims towards non-Muslims should drastically change. Instead of showing an antagonistic behavior towards them by threatening to subdue them, they should try to present the teachings of Islam in a lucid and articulate manner. They should think ways and means to communicate the true message of Islam and refrain from policing and threatening non-Muslims. Like true preachers, they should invest their time in thinking of ways and means to earnestly call people to the truth. Their preaching should have a humble tone in it, and they should deal very affectionately and amicably with non-Muslims. Muslims should consider them as their potential addressees to whom they can present the teachings of Islam through character and good deeds. Being antagonistic and hostile to them is a totally uncalled-for attitude. Moreover, all Muslim revivalist movements should keep in mind the fact that nowhere has the religion directed Muslims to struggle for the supremacy of Islam as an obligation. It is obvious that wherever they are in majority, Islam should be implemented, and where they are not, they should convince and educate people to win the majority. The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his companions never launched a struggle to establish an Islamic state. It was as per the divine practice discussed in this treatise that they were granted the rulership of a state. Hence, struggling to establish an Islamic state is not a directive of the Sharia. Here, it would be worthwhile to mention that if Muslims want to bring about any change like implementing Sharia laws in their own country or in the country they live in as a minority, Islam has bound them to adopt democratic means. They must educate and convince people in its favor until they enjoy the confidence of the majority. A minority group has not been given the right to impose its views on the majority. In this regard, it needs to be appreciated that the Quran is absolutely clear when it says, "Amruhum shura bainahum." The affairs of state of the believers are run by their mutual consultation. Surah number 42, verse 38. Keeping in view linguistic considerations, it is evident that a consensus or majority opinion of the Muslims can in no way be overruled. The Quran has not said the believers are consulted in their affairs. It has, on the contrary, declared their affairs of state are run by their mutual consultation. The style and pattern of the verse demands that an Islamic government should be established through the consultation of the believers, continue to exist on this basis, and should cease to exist without it. It should conduct its affairs in all cases on the basis of a consensus or majority opinion of the citizens. Muslims must therefore adopt democratic means to bring a change in the country, whether Muslim or non-Muslim, they are living in. They must also remember that as citizens of the non-Muslim countries, they are bound in a contract with that country. They must follow in letter and spirit the laws of the country whose citizens they have become by their own free choice. Abiding by laws is their religious duty. They must remember that people who break their promises are disliked by the Almighty. Moreover, if they feel that it is not possible for them to practice their religion because of some hindrance created by a law or ruling of that country, even then they should not disobey the law or cause any disruption. No doubt this is persecution and as such a condemnable act. However, the correct attitude in such instances would be to migrate from that country if every peaceful effort to achieve religious freedom fails. Today, the non-Muslim world has severe apprehensions about the Muslim bloc. To them, Muslims pose a great threat to their freedom and liberty. Muslims should come forward and put an end to the threat non-Muslims feel from them. The highly talked-of clash of civilizations should be converted into a dialogue between civilizations. Moreover, if the issues discussed in this treatise are found convincing, then the real threat to non-Muslims lies elsewhere. they must calmly contemplate the fate of deliberately denying the last messenger of God. They must keep in mind the fate of their ancestors in the prophetic times, a fate they met by intentionally denying him. However, the sword of Damocles does not hang over them in this world, at least. Whether they knowingly deny may or may not be known in this world, but surely in the hereafter this reality shall be unveiled. Such an attitude would lead them to the gravest of penalties. Similarly, they should also consider how a careless attitude in this regard may prove disastrous for them in the hereafter, for according to the Quran, the Almighty has sent His messengers and prophets so that man is left with no excuse to deny the truth. The Quran states, رُسُلًا مُبَشِّرِينَ وَمُنْزِرِينَ لِأَلَّا يَكُونَ لِلنَّاسِ عَلَى اللَّهِ حُجَّةٌ بَعْدَ الرُّسُلِ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ عَزِيزٌ حَكِيمًا. We sent messengers who gave glad tidings as well as warnings so that mankind, after the coming of these messengers, are left with no plea against the Almighty regarding the basic truths. For God is exalted in power, wise. Surah number 4, verse 165. Thus Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his preaching mission must always continue to be thought-provoking to non-Muslims, since it poses a threat to them in the hereafter if they deny him in spite of being convinced of his prophethood. They must keep in mind that as per the Quran, the Almighty has played his role in elucidating this fact. Only a legitimate excuse on their part can now save them on the day of judgment from his wrath.